You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Ambassador Robert Joseph, who is a senior scholar at the National Institute for Public Policy. Previously, he was Under Secretary of State for Arms Control and International Security and Special Envoy for Nuclear Nonproliferation. From January 2001 through November 2004, Dr. Joseph served in the National Security Council as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Proliferation Strategy, Counterproliferation, and Homeland Defense. Ambassador Joseph, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ambassador Joseph, I saw on the internet that there was a Senate briefing yesterday, and the title of it, Can Iran Deal in Good Faith? Now, you were there yesterday over at the Dirksen Senate office building from 11 to 1. I want to get into that in great detail in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, I just want to explain who it is that they're about to hear, because your name certainly is not a household name, but it should be, because besides all of the positions that you have held, and I just briefly mentioned, you have penned a book called Countering WMD, the Libyan Experience. So you were actually the lead negotiator when Gaddafi decided to surrender his weapons of mass destruction. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Wow. And again, listeners, the book is Countering WMD, the Libyan Experience, and that can be purchased over at the National Institute for Public Policy. Can you just briefly, Ambassador, let the listeners know what exactly is the National Institute for Public Policy?
It's one of the Washington think tanks, and the emphasis of the work that we do at the Institute is on proliferation, is on nuclear deterrence, particularly extended deterrence, working with our allies and friends around the world to achieve mutual objectives in the national security area.
And that website is NIPP.org. Yesterday's Senate briefing, I see that that was sponsored by the Iranian American Community of Arkansas. That's certainly not an organization that most people would have heard of, but they are a member of the Organization of Iranian American Communities, and I imagine these organizations are concerned about the image that Iran has in the United States. Would it be fair to say that?
Well, I think it's well beyond the image of Iran. They're very concerned about what is going on in Iran today, and particularly the brutal repression of the Iranian people by the mullahs.
Mm-hmm.
They seek change in Iran.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into this Senate briefing yesterday. Why don't you just give the listeners a recap of the hearing and who was there?
Yes, there were four speakers, former Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, General Jones, former Commandant of the Marine Corps and National Security Advisor for President Obama, Governor Howard Dean, former candidate for president, and myself. And the focus of the presentations were on recent events in Iran, particularly Iran's repression, both its repression of the domestic opposition, but also its efforts to reach out and intimidate through very brutal acts, including acts of murder, the opposition to the regime in Iran. My focus was on the interim accord that was signed in November and that recently went into effect, governing the nuclear program in Iran.
And besides the four participants, was there anyone else there?
Well, we had a very good-sized audience, and we had, I think, after the presentations, a very informative exchange.
Mm-hmm. So it did go from 11 to 1 or carried over a bit?
It ended around 12:30. It went for about an hour and a half.
Do you personally feel that Iran at this point has developed nuclear weapons?
Well, I think Iran has demonstrated the technical capability to have a nuclear weapon once it makes a political decision to do so. Whether or not they have made that political decision, it is unclear. I think General Clapper, the head of the U.S. intelligence community, testified just yesterday up on the Hill that Iran had the capability. It was only lacking the decision to move forward. My sense is we won't know when that decision is made. It could have already been made.
And it's no secret that President Obama, his administration, is interested in diplomacy, negotiating with Iran, versus, of course, the most outspoken critic of that, which is the State of Israel. What is your position on Israel's position?
Well, let's be clear about what Israel's position is. Israel, I think, like every other country, wants to have a negotiated diplomatic solution to this problem. What they're concerned about, and I certainly share this concern, is that we will get a bad deal. We'll get a bad outcome in the negotiations that will allow Iran to continue to be a nuclear threshold state and to acquire nuclear weapons covertly. That's the concern. It's not a question of whether or not Israel or others want a diplomatic solution. They do, but they don't want a bad agreement. They want an agreement that achieves the objectives that had long been stated by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. But the interim accord that was just, as I mentioned, just gone into effect last week, leaves open the pathways, both pathways for a nuclear weapon, both enriched uranium and plutonium.
And why do you think that the accord was structured in such a fashion?
And this is an interim accord, and the purpose of the interim accord is to provide time to negotiate a comprehensive solution. I just think the Iranians got the better of the deal. There are some positive aspects for us. The Iranians have agreed to halt further enrichment beyond 5%. They've also agreed to blend down or convert their stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, which could be easily further enriched to bomb-grade material. But the agreement is only for 6 months, and the activities that Iran has agreed to undertake are easily reversed. In fact, one Iranian spokesperson said that they could be reversed in one day. And these positive aspects come at a very high price. As I said, the pathways to a nuclear weapon are left open. Iran is granted in the interim agreement the right to enrich, despite denials to that effect by the administration. Just go out, read the text, and you will find that, in fact, it does talk about Iranian enrichment. Iran is allowed, even during these 6 months, even during this pause, to continue research and development. And, in fact, they have said that they're continuing to test advanced centrifuges that will provide more efficient and quicker ways to enrich uranium to weapons-grade material, if they so choose. The plutonium pathway is wide open. The six-month agreement does preclude Iran from installing certain equipment into the plutonium reactor that they're building at Iraq, but they probably wouldn't have done that anyway in the next 6 months. And the Iranians, again, have made very clear, very explicit, that they're continuing with that construction.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also point out that the price that we pay for this agreement is to undercut sanctions. And sanctions have been the key to leverage. The sanctions are the reason the Iranians came back to the table in the first place. And there are significant sanctions relief on oil exports, on auto industry imports, on the export and import of gold and other precious materials that will allow Iran to expand its oil exports, and of course access to frozen funds, over $4 billion in frozen funds. But I think the momentum on sanctions has been shifted. And in fact, if you look at the reception that President Rouhani received in Davos, Switzerland last week, it's very clear that many countries are eager to reestablish their commercial relationships with Iran and to continue to import more and more Iranian oil. Without sanctions, I don't think there's really any prospect that the final comprehensive agreement, if we ever get there, will be favorable to us. And in fact, that's another point, and it's one that I raised yesterday. My concern is that we will get into a round of endless negotiations that will lead us nowhere, but that will simply only provide more time for Iran to build up its nuclear infrastructure. Iran has always used negotiations for that effect. And I think the Obama administration believes that talking to Iran is better under all circumstances than the use of force. And I think Israel very well may, at least many in Israel very well may, believe the same thing. And the Obama administration is now so heavily invested in these negotiations that I really don't think they're going to be willing to declare failure. And so you'll have, in my expectation, this continuing round after round of negotiations, maybe a framework agreement, maybe step-by-step approaches, but you won't have what we have all sought, and that is a diplomatic outcome that precludes Iran from maintaining its ability to acquire a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm. If it doesn't turn out the way that you and others are hoping, would you be supportive of an Israeli strike?
Everyone talks about the use of force as a last resort, the use of force if diplomacy fails. My sense is that diplomacy never really fails. Just like sanctions, we might have to use force, or the Israelis may have to use force, to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. They believe it to be an existential threat to their very existence, and it likely is. And if that's what is required, I certainly would support it. But I agree with all of those who say we've got to give diplomacy a chance. But diplomacy has to be focused on an outcome. Diplomacy is not an end in itself. Diplomacy has to be focused on achieving an objective, and that objective in this case has to be, I believe, no enrichment on the part of Iran, no plutonium reactor, total verification and monitoring, and compelling Iran to come clean on the activities that are of most concern to the IAEA, and those are activities related to weaponization. We've got to achieve those objectives. If we can't achieve those objectives, then the use of force is, I think, much better than the alternative of allowing Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Because if Iran acquires a nuclear weapon or is perceived by others as having the capacity and the will to move forward with a nuclear weapon, that's going to touch off a lot of proliferation in the region and, I think, lead to a breakdown of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. I come at this from a non-proliferation perspective. And so the Iran nuclear challenge has to be, in my view, seen in a much broader context. Mm-hmm. And it has to be seen in the regional context, and it has to be seen even beyond the region. And I think if we fail in Iran, the stakes are enormous, and it's going to be a much more dangerous world with a lot more countries having nuclear weapons.
Okay. And how much time do you think would be allowed to deal diplomatically with Iran? Because you said it could probably carry on for a while after the interim agreement. Are you talking another 6 months after that, or a year or 2 years? How much time would you give before, for example, you were more supportive of an Israeli strike?
Time is always difficult to judge. One has to look at where we are now. Are we headed in the right direction? President Obama, in his State of the Union address, said that American diplomacy, and this is almost a quote, I don't have the language in front of me, but American diplomacy has halted the progress of Iran's nuclear program. That is simply not true. That is simply not the case. As I said, the agreement leaves open both pathways to acquiring fissile material for a nuclear weapon. The agreement does not compel Iran to come clean on its past weaponization activities. It undercuts the sanctions regime. I think we're on a path to failure. I can't tell you, is it a month, is it 2 months, is it 3 months? But once we see the negotiations failing, I think clearly the imposition of more sanctions is required. And if we get to the point where Iran is on that threshold of acquiring a nuclear weapon, force is entirely justified. Remember, we have 5 or 6 UN Security Council resolutions that have demanded that Iran cease its enrichment and its construction of the plutonium reactor in Iraq, which is a location in Iran, to be clear.
You have said that if Iran does acquire nuclear weapons, that you could see a proliferation of these weapons in the region. What exactly did you mean? Who would that be? I mean, because Israel has nuclear weapons, although they have their policy of amimut, which is opacity. They neither admit nor deny that they have them. But who else would you think be in a position to proliferate?
Well, I think clearly the Saudis are concerned. The Saudis have said they're very concerned about Iran. They also see Iran as an existential threat, a threat to their very survival, and in fact, a threat in terms of the future of Islam. The Saudis have been very concerned about what they see, and others in the Gulf, in the Middle East more broadly, about what they see as policy shifts by the Obama administration, the abandonment of our ally Mubarak in Egypt, the punishment of the Bahraini regime for suppressing the opposition, the talk about shifting to Asia, the pullout in Iraq without leaving any residual force, and watch what's going on in Iraq today, the drawdown in Afghanistan. Policy shift after policy shift has left many of our friends wondering about the credibility of the U.S. as an ally. This, along with Iran moving forward with its nuclear program, being granted this right to enrichment, which will lead to it becoming a nuclear threshold state, is undoubtedly having an effect on the calculations of these governments. And I would be shocked if they weren't considering, if not already well on the way, to moving forward with their own nuclear programs.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually meet Gaddafi during those negotiations, Ambassador?
I didn't negotiate directly with Gaddafi. That's not the way the Libyan system worked under Gaddafi. I did meet him, but we negotiated with his team.
Mm-hmm. Would you be willing, if the opportunity arose, to do the same in Iran?
It's not going to arise in this administration. I can guarantee you that. You were kind enough to mention the book that I did on the Libyan experience. And that book, in addition to providing a chronology of the events in 2003 and 2004, and talking about the motivations of the Libyan regime, also talks about a number of lessons learned. And some of those lessons learned apply to Iran. Iran and Libya are different. Iran, North Korea are different. Again, I'm coming at this from a non-proliferation perspective. All the countries are different. But some of these lessons clearly apply to Iran. And at some point, I'd be happy to talk to you about those.
Ambassador Robert Joseph, I want to thank you so much, sir, for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thank you much.